Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Strength is More Than a Word podcast. I'm your host, Leo Burnside, and boy, does that feel good to say again. It's been a while since I released an episode, and honestly, life has been a lot. School started to pick up, my mental health demanded attention, especially my hip, and I had to take a step back to center myself. Healing can be loud, messy, unpredictable. And I've learned it rarely goes in a straight line. But I'm here. I'm growing, and I'm grateful you're still here with me. But even in the chaos, even in the pain, even in the pauses, I've really missed this. I've missed the conversations, the vulnerability, the impact, and the connection that this podcast has brought into my life. And I've missed you guys. So thank you for being here again. Before anything else, I want to start with something simple but powerful. Thank you. Truly. Thank you. If you told me before my injury, before the darkest moments of my life, that I would have my podcast with over 150,000 streams across just 4 episodes, I would have told you that you're absolutely insane. If you told me that I would write a book, publish it, share my story with hundreds of strangers, and donate over $4,500 to nonprofits, I would have told you that there's just no way. Not even in a million years. Because back then, I didn't see myself the way I do now. Back then, I didn't think I had anything worth sharing. Back then, I didn't think my voice mattered. But this journey, every person who pressed play, every message, every review, every tear shed during recordings, it all showed me something I never expected. My pain could build something. My story could help someone. My voice could matter. And that's something I'll never take for granted. There are some people I need to thank personally for the success, because this podcast is not something I created alone. It stands on the shoulders of people who helped me through some of my hardest moments of my life. First, Natalie and Nava. Let me start with these two incredible people. You both have no idea how much you've given to this podcast. Together, your episodes have brought in over 80,000 streams, nearly half of this podcast's entire reach. But what means more than any number is the bravery behind it. Talking about mental health requires you to walk back into the memories your body has tried to forget. It forces you to look at versions of yourself you wish didn't exist. And yet, you both still showed up. You didn't just show up, you opened up. You shared parts of your story that were raw, painful, and deeply personal. And you did it so that someone else could feel understood. The number of people who reached out to me after your episodes, telling me you made them feel seen, telling me that they finally asked for help, telling me they finally understood their own struggles. That's something I hope you both carry with pride for the rest of your lives. Then, to my sister Hayden, my best friend. Now let's talk about someone who means more than anything she'll ever know. When this podcast was just an idea, when it's simply a thought in the back of my mind, I went to her first. I told her that her story could change lives, but she wasn't sure if she was ready, and that was okay. Healing isn't something you rush, especially when trauma runs deep. Months ended up going by, and then one day she came to me and said, "I'm ready." Those two words were powerful than she even realized. Her episode now has over 40,000 streams, the fastest growing episode we've ever released. But the numbers don't tell the whole story. The power of her episode came from watching her share something that once nearly broke her. The strength it took to speak those words, I'll just never forget it. I remember during the recording, she stepped out to run an errand. And the second she left, I completely broke down. I cried. Not just because of what she went through, but because I realized how strong she truly is. She faced her trauma head on, knowing she would have to relive it. The kind of courage is rare. And it's one of the reasons I found the bravery to share my story too. Then to my aunt, Christy, and Uncle Doug, These two people are like second parents to me. They have been my safe place throughout this injury. They have listened to every rant, every idea, and every fear. They helped me shape this podcast, improve my book, and stay grounded. They have been the constants in my season of uncertainty, and I will always be grateful for that. Then to my grandparents. Both sets of my grandparents have been some of my loudest supporters. They always showed up, and I mean always, whether it was cheering me on in sports, encouraging my academic goals, or supporting every step of this healing journey. They've been there with open arms and open hearts. And then to my parents. My mom has been with me since the very beginning of this nightmare. She was there the moment my injury began, when I hobbled onto the bus in England, where I could barely stand that pain. She was there at every appointment, every doctor's visit, every therapy session, every moment where I questioned everything. She carried my fears when I couldn't carry them myself. We've had our disagreements, especially about my injury and the future of it, but even in the hardest conversations, one thing has always been true. Everything she does is out of love. She is my foundation, my protector, and the strongest person that I know. Then to my dad. This part is always very hard for me to say, but it's important. My dad is one of the reasons why I'm alive today. There was a night where I didn't want to exist anymore. A night where I was tired of the pain, tired of my identity loss, tired of everything. And my dad had a conversation with me that I never will forget. Hearing his voice break, hearing the fear of it, hearing him begging for me not to give up. It changed me. It opened my eyes. People sometimes forget that men feel deeply, that fathers feel deeply, and hearing the raw emotion in his voice showed me that my life mattered more than I believed at the time. My dad pushes me, sometimes a little too much, sometimes in ways I don't want, but now I understand why. He sees potential in me that I don't always see in myself. Mom, Dad, if you're listening to this, I love you guys, and thank you for keeping me here. And then I also want to thank all of my other family members and friends who've supported me throughout this long battle and continue to support me as I keep on progressing. Now, let's really get into this episode. When I look back at soccer, the sport that shaped me, I see a version of myself that I didn't know how to exist without it. Soccer wasn't a hobby. It was my identity, my introduction, my coping mechanism, my escape. It was the one place where I felt powerful, the place where I felt safe, the one place where I felt I mattered. So when the injury hit, when the doctor said I needed to medically retire, it shattered everything. I didn't just lose a sport. I lost my sense of self. I lost the future I imagined. I lost the control I depended on. And suddenly, I didn't know who Leo was anymore. That loss created a kind of emptiness I didn't know how to fill. And in that desperation, I turned something I never thought I would never do. Self-harm. I didn't do it because I wanted to die. I did it because I wanted to feel something I could control. For a few seconds, it gave me that. And then the guilt crushed over me. To this day, I still look at my scars. I still rub my fingers over them when it feels like it's spinning too fast. And every time, I wish I could go back and tell that version of myself that he deserved better. That he wasn't alone. That losing soccer didn't mean he was losing himself. But I can't go back. But what I can do is use my story to help someone who's standing where I once stood. The addiction that no one talks about. Here's where things get real. Athletes are becoming addicts, not to drugs, not to alcohol, but to the feeling sport gives them. The rush, the praise, the success, the identity, the high of winning, the high of improvement, and the high of being somebody. And like any addiction, once it's taken away, the crash is brutal. Most people understand that an athlete's brain literally rewires itself around the cycle of reward. The better you get, the more you crave it. The more competitive the sport becomes, the stronger the dependency becomes. So when you get injured, or benched, or failed, or retire, it hits you like a truck. You feel empty. You feel lost. You feel like your life doesn't have purpose anymore. Athletes go through withdrawal, real withdrawal, and no one talks about it. No one teaches you how to let go. No one prepares you for the day that your sport ends. But I'm here to tell you, your sport is not your identity. Your worth is not tied into a jersey. Your strength is not measured by how hard you push your body. You are allowed to hurt. You are allowed to grieve. And you're allowed to feel lost. But you're not allowed to believe that your story ends when your sport does. Mine did it, and neither will yours. We need to break the stigma. Athletes are taught, be tough, push through, don't be weak, don't show emotion, don't ask for help. And that mindset is killing people. Literally. Strength isn't pretending you are fine. Strength isn't hiding your pain. Strength isn't playing through injuries. Strength isn't silence. Strength is honesty. Strength is vulnerability. Strength is choosing to stay. Strength is choosing to heal. And that is what this podcast is about. That is what my book is about. And that's what my life is becoming about. Not soccer, not injuries, not perfection, but healing. Real healing. The kind that takes time, the kind that hurts, and the kind that saves you. Now I want to touch on current events about mental health. A few weeks ago, the entire sports world, and honestly, anybody who follows football, even casually, was hit with the news that didn't feel real. The kind of news that makes you reread a headline over and over because your brain refuses to believe it. Marshawn Nyland, a 24-year-old defense end for the Dallas Cowboys, a young man whose NFL career had barely begun, was gone. An apparent suicide. A moment that shook not just the Cowboys organization, not just NFL fans, but anyone who has ever looked at an athlete and thought, they have everything. How could something like this happen? And that's the part that cuts the deepest. Marshawn wasn't someone struggling, a forgotten player. He wasn't someone people had given up on, or someone who has disappeared into the background of a roster. He was a first-year player with an explosive potential. Analysts were calling him one of the steals of the draft, a guy with size, speed, bend, and work ethic. He already made highlight reels. He had already recorded his first career touchdown on special teams by sheer effort and instinct. He already built the foundation of what looked like a long, successful career. Outwardly, he was a definition of living the dream. Fans were rooting for him. Coaches were investing in him. Teammates were embracing him. People in Dallas were starting to learn his name. But here's the part we forget too often. Success doesn't make someone invincible. Talent doesn't erase the pain. Fame doesn't silence the battles in your mind. According to police reports, before Marshawn died, he was involved in a pursuit after failing to stop for officers. The chase ended with his vehicle crashing, and he fled on foot. Officers later found him with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Before this happened, he had reportedly sent a group text to loved ones, a message that sounded like a goodbye, a message people close to him now look back on with heartbreaking guilt, wondering if they could have done something, said something, seen something. His girlfriend shared that he had struggled with depression, that he had talked about ending his life before, that he carried weight that no one else saw. Not his coaches, not his teammates, not even the fans who cheered him on Sundays. And when his family released their statement, it wasn't just a typical press release. It was raw. It was shattered. It was the sound of a family trying to find language for a pain that doesn't have words. They talked about Marshawn, how he was a protector, a gentle soul, a young man who loved deeply and showed up for everyone, even when he couldn't show up for himself. His agent said he was heartbroken, not only because the league lost a promising athlete, but because the world lost a kind person who made rooms feel warmer just by being in them. His teammates described his energy, the quiet confidence, the way he pushed himself, the way he would joke around in the locker room, the way he fought for every inch on the field. And that's what makes it so hard. Because when you hear all of that, you realize something that we don't talk about enough. Even the strongest looking men in the world can be breaking inside. Even the men who are idolized, praised, called warriors, called machines, called beasts. Even the ones society paints as unshakable. The NFL responded quickly, offering counseling resources to players and staff. Several teams released statements acknowledging the mental health crisis happening within sports. But one of the most powerful responses came from players themselves. Across social media, across locker rooms, across interviews, you heard the same phrase echo again and again. We are hurting too. We are fighting battles too. We are human too. And this is where we need to take a pause. Not as fans, not as people who consume sports, but as human beings. And have to really let that sink in. Because Marshawn's death isn't an isolated strategy. Not even close. In the last decade, a number of athletes, college, professional, even high school, struggling with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts have skyrocketed. We've seen NCAA athletes die by suicide. We've seen NBA players take mental health breaks. We've seen Olympians admit that they were suffering in silence. But beneath it all, there's an even bigger problem. A problem that extends far beyond sports. A problem that sits in the center of this entire tragedy. Men are struggling at a staggering, devastating rate, and they are not speaking up. In the United States, men die by suicide nearly 4 times more often than women. Just let that sink in. 4 times. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention reports that in 2023, the suicide rate among men was 22.8 per 100,000, compared to the 5.9 per 100,000 among women. Men make up about 80% of all the suicide deaths in this country. And yet, when you look at the rates of diagnosed depression or anxiety, women report higher rates, which means men are hurting deeply, but they aren't reaching out. A 2023 study from UCLA shows that men often express emotional pain differently. Instead of the phrases, "I feel sad," men talk about losing control, feeling angry, feeling like a burden, feeling hopeless about work or identity. Because society has taught men that vulnerability equals weakness, they bury these feelings. They mask them. They push them down. They say, "I'm fine," even when they feel like they're falling apart. And because they rarely seek help, their crisis escalates quickly, until it's too late. Professional athletes experience this at even more intense levels. They are trained from childhood to suppress pain, to quote-unquote push through, to tough it out. They are told emotions are a distraction. They are praised when they fight through injury. They're celebrated when they keep silent and keep grinding. They are conditioned to believe that their worth is tied to their performance, their toughness, their ability to endure. And then one day, something breaks. Identity. Pressure. Isolation. Public scrutiny. Fear of failure. Fear of letting people down. Fear of being replaced. And fear of being seen as weak. These pressures build until the mind can't hold them anymore. And sadly, the story becomes, how could this happen? When the signs were there all along, society just never allowed men to show them. Marshawn Nealon wasn't weak. He wasn't cowardly. He wasn't selfish. He was a young man fighting a battle that millions of men fight every single day. A battle against silence, shame, stigma, and the crushing belief that they are not allowed to ask for help. He is gone not because he lacks strength, but because the world lacks space for men to be vulnerable without judgment. His story shouldn't break us, not just because his story should break us, not just because of the loss, but because of what it reveals about the world men are forced to live in. And if you're listening to this, whether you're an athlete, a student, a father, a son, a coach, or someone just trying to make it through another day, hear this clearly. You are allowed to hurt. You're allowed to talk. You're allowed to ask for help. You're allowed to feel. Strength is not silence. Strength is not pretending. Strength is not holding everything until it collapses. Strength is letting someone into your world before it becomes too heavy to carry alone. Marshawn's story cannot be changed, but it can change us. It can push us to reach out more, to listen harder, to check on the men in our lives even when it seems quote-unquote fine. To look past the armor, past the smiles, past the achievements, past the toughness. Because you never know who needs it. And sometimes, a simple moment of connection is the difference between losing someone and saving them. Across this country, the failure of our mental health system is no longer something we can politely debate or quietly ignore. It is visible, painfully, unmistakably visible. In every city, every town, every sidewalk where a person is suffering from untreated mental health wanders without direction or hope. They are not just statistics. They are human beings who have slipped into the shadows because we didn't build a system capable of catching them. Some of them were once students with full scholarships. Some were fathers who lost their jobs. Some were teenagers who never received the therapy they needed. Some were veterans carrying invisible wounds. Many are people who could have been helped if the help existed. But what happens instead is predictable, almost mechanical in its strategy. People hit a crisis point, something snaps, something spirals. And so the person who needs care becomes a call, a problem, a situation, a danger. In that moment, the moment a family member panics, a neighbor calls 911, or a driver reports someone standing in traffic, the responsibility doesn't fall on the trained psychiatrist, a crisis counselor, or a mental health professional. It falls on law enforcement again and again and again. We treat officers like the catch-all safety net of society. Someone is suicidal, call the police. Someone is delusional and screaming at passing cars, call the police. Someone is armed while experiencing a break from reality, call the police. Someone is barricaded in their home because they believe monsters are trapped inside the walls, call the police. The list is endless. And with every call, we place officers at the intersection of danger and desperation. A crossroad they were never meant to stand in alone. These officers aren't therapists. They are not clinicians. They are not psychiatrists. Yet, we keep sending them to the living rooms and bedrooms and where untreated illness is boiling over. We expect them to walk into chaos with nothing but a bulletproof vest, crisis intervention training that lasts a few days, in the hope that their words will reach someone whose mind is drowning. Crisis intervention training that lasts a few days, in the hope that their words will reach someone whose mind isn't drowning in fear or hallucination. And we say, quote-unquote, de-escalate, as if de-escalation is always possible, and as if their presence or of a badge and a gun doesn't heighten fear for someone whose perception is already shattered, as if a single officer's voice can cut through psychosis. And because of the systematic failure, officers across the United States are dying. Not in a quote-unquote dramatic Hollywood shootouts, not during drug raids, not in chases involving cartel fugitives. They are dying on mental health calls, quiet, everyday calls that sound harmless on the radio. Welfare check, subject acting strange, possible suicidal individual, calls that should have been handled by a clinician, not a cop. And here in North Carolina, the heartbreak struck home with a devastating force. Wake County Sheriff's Deputy Jose Fierro lost his life responding to a man who wasn't a criminal, but a person in the throes of a severe mental health breakdown. Deputy Fierro walked into that situation because the system gave him no other option. He was doing what officers do, showing up when no one else would, stepping into a danger so others didn't have to. He was met with fear, paranoia, instability, and a level of volatility that no officer, not even the most experienced, can fully prepare for. In that moment, that should never have belonged to a law enforcement in the first place. Deputy Fiara was shot and killed. He died not because he did something wrong, but because the system that should have protected both him and the man in the crisis was already broken before he ever arrived. And behind his badge was a husband, a father, a friend, a son, a man whose life mattered deeply, a man who should have made it home that night, a man whose death should have shaken lawmakers, mental health leaders, and communities to their core. Because the painful truth is, he's not the first officer to die this way, and he will not be the last if nothing changes. Across the country, the stories echo each other with horrifying consistency. In California, an officer was killed responding to a schizophrenic man wielding a knife during an episode. In Tennessee, a deputy lost his life while trying to help a suicidal man armed with a shotgun. In New York, officers responding to a bipolar crisis were shot by someone who believed that they were imposters working against them. These are not criminals targeting police. These are people in crisis who need treatment, not confrontation. But because there was no mental health team to call, the police went, and the police died. And what makes these deaths even more tragic is the officers often know exactly how dangerous these calls are. Many of them talk about it privately, how mental health calls are the ones that make their heart race, the ones that they fear the most, because the unpredictability is terrifying. A traffic stop has rules. A robbery has patterns. A domestic dispute has known risks. But a mind of an unraveling is chaos. It's speed. It's volatility. It's a moving target that doesn't follow logic or instinct or fear. An officer can be calm, trained, compassionate, patient, and still lose their life because the person in crisis cannot tell the difference between help and danger. And yet, we keep sending officers anyway, knowing full well that they're walking into situations designed for professionals with years of clinical training. We're asking the impossible of them, and every year, officers die for it. This is why our system has to change. We need a separate organization, a dedicated crisis response force made up of psychiatric specialists, mental health nurses, trauma-informed counselors, de-escalation experts, and medical professionals trained specifically to respond to mental health emergencies. People who arrive not with guns or ballistic vests, but with knowledge, patience, medication, and strategies proven to stabilize a crisis without escalating it. People who understand schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, psychosis, PTSD, addiction, trauma. People who know how to interpret symptoms, not misinterpret them. People whose very presence, not threatening, calm, civilian, can diffuse tension before it turns tragic. Imagine we're a world where these teams respond first, where officers only are alive if safety requires it. And even then, with backup from clinicians, imagine how many officers would still be alive today. Imagine how many mentally ill individuals would still be alive today. Imagine how many families would be spared the grief of losing a loved one, whether that loved one is the person in crisis or the officer trying to help them. We already know this works. Programs like CAHOOTS in Eugene, Oregon, and STAR in Denver have responded to tens of thousands of calls with astonishing statistics. Almost none required police intervention. No officers endangered, no civilians killed, no situations spiraling into tragedy, just professionals doing the job that they were trained to do. It is time to bring that motto nationwide, because the cost of doing nothing isn't measured in money. It's measured in funerals, in folded flags handed to children too young to understand why their dad isn't coming home. In grieving police departments, in traumatized communities, and mentally ill individuals who never received the care that they desperately needed. Deputy Fiaro's death should be a turning point, not just a headline. A reminder that officers are not disposable shields. They are human beings, and the weight of our unbroken mental health system has fallen onto them for far too long. The system must change. This response must change. And we owe it to every officer who kissed their family goodbye before responding to a mental health call and never came back, to make that change happen now. At the end of the day, everything we've talked about comes back to one truth. We are losing people, good people, because the systems meant to protect them are breaking under their feet. We have watched it happen with Marshawn Kneeland, a professional athlete who seemed untouchable from the outside, yet was fighting battles no camera ever caught. We see it happening in our cities, where those struggling with untreated mental health, mental illnesses slip through the cracks until they're living on the sidewalks, abandoned by a system that was supposed to lift them up. And we see it happening to the officers who responded to those crises day after day. Officers who walk into unpredictable, volatile situations with nothing but training meant for criminals, not for people with psychological collapse. Officers like the one we lost in Wake County, who showed up because someone had to, who stepped into the chaos because no one else was equipped or sent. These aren't isolated tragedies. They are symptoms of a deeper failure, a failure of infrastructure, a failure of policy, a failure of compassion. And it's time we stop predicting that police can absorb the fallout of a broken mental health system. They can't. They're dying because of it. That's why the solution isn't more pressure on law enforcement. It's building something new, a specialized crisis response organization made of mental health professionals trained to handle breakdowns, delusions, or idealizations in emotional emergencies with calm expertise instead of force. People who aren't intimidating, who aren't triggering, who aren't seen as a threat by those already terrified of the world around them. A system where police come when they are truly needed, but aren't used as the front line for every failing of society. We owe that to the homeless man hearing voices under an overpass. We owe it to the veteran battling PTSD on the edge of a breakdown. We owe it to Marshawn Kneeland, to every man who suffers in the silence because he thinks he isn't allowed to speak. And we owe it to every officer who straps on a vest and hopes, quietly, that today won't be the day that the system fails them too. So if you take anything from this episode, let it be this. None of this is hopelessness. Change is possible. But it starts with admitting that what we are doing right now isn't working. It starts with demanding better. Better support, better access, better structures, better compassion. Because the cost of ignoring this isn't measured in statistics or headlines. It is measured in the empty seats at our dinner tables. It's measured in the names we speak with the past tense because help arrived too late or in the wrong form. And if we really believe that life, every life matters, every athlete, every homeless man, every struggling kid, every officer, then we have a responsibility to fight for a system that proves it. This isn't just a conversation. It's a call. A call for awareness, for reform, for humanity. A call to finally build a world where people don't slip through the cracks and where the ones who come running to save us don't lose their lives doing it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Strength is More Than a Word. And I want to say thank you to everybody again for believing in me and just doing everything in their power to help me. Thank you guys. Love you guys.